This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist anthropologist, the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative, and a current Soros Justice Fellow. I'm also a member of the Practitioners Lab offered by Common Justice, which is a restorative justice organization located in New York City that has pioneered a model of how to work with district attorneys to refer cases of very serious violence to an intensive accountability and healing-focused restorative justice process rather than to courts and prison. My guest today is also a member of the Practitioners Lab, in addition to many other roles, which we'll continue to talk about. I'm so thrilled to welcome back to the show Kempis Songster, who goes by Ghani, who is currently the Transformative Healing and Restorative Justice Manager for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. We talked on Justice Radio last month, and this episode is a continuation of our conversation. So welcome back to the show, Ghani.
Hey, Catherine, it's great to be back. You know, I'm ready to pick up where we left off. I know we took a deep dive, you know, and I'm looking forward to going even deeper with you.
Yeah, we got a lot to talk about. So even though I first met you in person through the Practitioners Lab, I had heard of you, and this is what we talked about last time, through the 2021 article that you co-authored called Redeeming Justice that was published in the Northwestern University Law Review. This article is amazing. It's breathtaking because it makes a really powerful, moving case for the abolition of life sentences. The article asks, what does it mean for the law to judge some human beings as incapable of redemption? Isn't the capacity for change core to the human condition? And shouldn't that be reflected in the law? So today's show is the second in our series on Ghani's work toward abolishing life sentences and promoting restorative justice in cases of harm. The Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth works to end life without parole and other extreme sentences for children in the United States. And it's also invested in healing individuals directly impacted by youth violence and extreme sentences. Today, we're going to pick up where we left off last time about how Ghani went from prison to working on this campaign as a free man. So, Ghani, we ended our last episode with your work on the inside on the right to redemption, which was a campaign picked up by the UN and ultimately culminating in your release in 2017. So let's start there. You were condemned at the age of 16 to die in prison. What happened? How did you end up being where you are today?
Yeah, I'm condemned too at the age of 15, actually.
15.
Yeah, yeah. Because actually, you know, I mean, even though my trial was a year after I was actually arrested, your sentence takes effect the minute you go into custody. You know what I mean? When I was arrested on September 29th, 1987, and was released on December 28th, 2017, 30 years and 3 months later. So it was from my incarceration was from the age of 15 to the age of 45. And again, you know, you pointed out, the sentence was a condemnatory sentence. I was sentenced to what's called life without parole, you know, and you know, we talked about how we challenged that language. You know, we call it what it is, death by incarceration. And so the only reason why I'm here from a death by incarceration sentence is because of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling, Miller versus Alabama, that came down on June 25th, 2012. And that ruling was actually built on some previous rulings, starting with Roper versus Simmons back in 2005. Roper versus Simmons was about the ruling made it unconstitutional for children to be sentenced given the death penalty and placed on death row. And so even though that's a long time ago, I know I can remember 2005 like as vivid as yesterday. You know what I mean? I know that makes me sound old. You know what I mean? But it is what it is. I remember 2005 and I remember when the ruling came down. And so as recent as 2005, this country still had children condemned to death row in this country. Roper versus Simmons ended that, or was supposed to have ended that. As far as I'm aware, Pennsylvania still has that sentence on its books for children. You know, they may not have enacted it, you know, on anyone, but it's still on its books. So, you know, quite possibly the ship hasn't totally sailed on that kind of scenario where a young person could be condemned to die in prison. But Well, to die on death row. And the reason, and what really is interesting too, right, Catherine, what influenced that decision was a few things, was an international push. That's when it really started. Because I think just 2 months prior to the Roper versus Simmons ruling coming down in March of 2005, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch released a collaborative report called The Rest of Their Lives. And it was the first and definitive report on the sentencing of children to life without parole. That's when we learned, and when I learned, and so many of us in all around the country learned that we were in this distinct class of people who are condemned. Up to that point, I didn't know that I was in a special group beyond somebody that was sentenced to life without parole. I didn't know that I was in this group that was now that was that warrants a wider latitude, a consideration of a wider latitude of mitigating factors, to the harm that I was condemned for.
This is, sorry,
And
Connie, to interrupt. This is because we're an international outlier. Like the group that you were among, children condemned to die in prison, is world. We're the only country that does that.
I would, encourage everybody to go back and read that report the rest of their lives. I mean, it's an old report, but I mean, that's when it that's the report that kind of like started it for us, and it showed a lot of us the role that the international community, that international law, human rights law would play in our fight for justice and in liberation. We might not be where we are if it wasn't for the international community weighing in. That's where we learned that 120, maybe 24 nations, probably more than that, but combined, had rejected sentencing children to die in prison on life without parole sentences. The whole world combined had, that's when we learned that the whole world had no one sentenced to die in prison for something they did as a child, that America was the only one that did that, not just the only one, but had like 2,800 people so sentenced, and that's when we learned that the Convention on the Rights of a Child, which is the world's most universally ratified human rights treaty, right? I think was Article 37B C, I believe it is, or B6, but it's definitely Article 37, where it says that neither death penalty or life in prison without the possibility of release shall be imposed on someone under the age of 18. And America had always been a signatory on this treaty. America signed off on it, but just never ratified it. You know what I mean? And continue to be one of the biggest obstructionists to relief for children condemned to die in prison. So that's what started it. Then Roper versus Simmons came down. And what made Roper versus Simmons so special as a ruling to come down 2 months after this report that came out by the Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch was this was the first time that, I mean, you had eight different scientific and medical institutes weighed in on amicus curiae briefs on this case and presented overwhelming empirical evidence. I'm talking about real evidence, not just theories, but things that were studied in laboratories, as it relates to the human brain, and they presented really one thing about the human brain, which is the underdevelopment of the prefrontal cortex, specifically the frontal lobe, right? And this information educated and influenced the US Supreme Court and its decision. And they arrived at three main conclusions based on this scientific evidence, which is that children are have less reliable, their decision making capacity is diminished, and less responsible, right? And the second is that they have less capacity to extricate themselves from certain situations that may be criminogenic, you know what I mean? Peer pressures and so on and so forth. And finally, because of the transience of youth, because of, and not just that, but because of the malleability of the brain, and we think about neuroplasticity, the capacity of a young person, whatever, character issues or personality issues that led to the offense, the capacity of it to subside with positive intention is greater than with older people and so on and so forth. So those three things. And the US Supreme Court was like, look, these findings, is in line with the evolving standards of decency that marks the project of a maturing society. That was the language.
Children's brains are just not mature, and we know that because we don't let them vote, and we know that because we don't let them drink, and we know that because
Right.
we let them drive until they're, they get a
And
license.
get married.
We don't let them get married. So I'm just curious, Ghani. I'm going to interject a question here before we return to the right to redemption and the work that you've done. What is it about American legal culture or American public culture, do you think, in our history that made it okay to condemn children to die in prison?
Here's the thing, and it's interesting because, and thank you for that question, because it baffled me that we even need scientists to come along and tell us, you know what I mean, as parents, that children are different. You know what I mean? Like everyone knows that. And I think about something that Aristotle said 2,500 years ago, right?
Here we
20, and
go.
listen, he said this, and I'm gonna close my eyes because I know your listeners can't tell, but you can tell. This has seared itself in my memory. And he said, in terms of their character, the young are prone to desires and inclined to do whatever they desire. And they are impulsive and quick-tempered and inclined to follow up their anger by action. And they are unable to resist their impulses, for through love of honor, they cannot put up with being belittled, but become indignant if they think they are done a wrong. But though they love honor, they love victory more, for youth longs for superiority, and victory is a kind of superiority. And they are filled with good hopes, for like those drinking wine, the young are heated by their nature, and at the same time, they are filled with good hopes because of not yet having experienced much failure. And they live for the most part in hope, for hope is for the future, and memory is of what has gone by. But for the young, the future is long and the past short. For in the dawn of life, nothing can be remembered and everything can be hoped for. And they are easily deceived for the reason given, for they easily hope for the best. And they are more courageous than the other age groups, for they are impulsive and filled with good hopes. For no one feels fear when angry, and to expect something good is a source of confidence. And they are sensitive to shame, for they have been educated only by convention and do not yet understand other fine things. And they are magnanimous, for they have not yet been worn down by life, but are inexperienced with constraints. And to think oneself worthy of greatness is magnanimity. And this is characteristic of a person of good hopes. For they live more by natural character than by calculation, because calculation concerns the advantageous and virtue, the honorable. And more than other ages of life, they are fond of friends and eager for companions. For they enjoy living with others and do not yet judge anything on the basis of advantage. Thus, they do not judge friends that way. And the wrongs they commit come from excess and vehemence. for they do everything too much. They love too much and hate too much and all other things similarly. And they think they know everything and strongly insist on it, for this is the cause of their doing everything too much. And the mistakes they make are in the direction of insolence, not maliciousness. And they are inclined to pity because of supposing that everyone is good or at least better than average. And they are fond of laughter and, as a result, witty. For wit is cultured insolence. Such then is the character of the young. End quote. Aristotle wrote that 2,500 years ago.
Wow.
2,500 years ago. So, I mean, in his, this is in his treatise on rhetoric, entitled On Rhetoric.
This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, and today we're having a conversation with Kempis Ghani Songster about his life journey, being condemned to die in prison at the age of 15, to finally gaining his freedom after 30 years inside, and his work in making an argument that every human being has the right to redemption.
Some, I don't know, that's some centuries later, you know, Paul would write in, I think it was 1 Corinthians 11, 13, I think it is. When I was a child, I thought as a child, I understood as a child, I spoke as a child. And when I became an adult, I put away childish things. Right. So all throughout history, and if you think about, like, even in West African, not just Western, but all in other cultures, like in the Udu Ifa, it talks about, you know, it says, Iwa isekusel ewolese, Iwa ihukuhu nitil alagbala. And that means bad conduct is attributed to youth, bad character is attributed to elders. You know what I'm saying? So all around the world, from Aristotle through all different cultures, there was like this consensus that children are different. You know what I'm saying? We didn't need neuroscientists thousands of years later to come along and tell us that children were different. We always knew this. You know what I'm saying? We always knew this. And different communities, whether it's the scientific, philosophical communities, we talked about Aristotle, or the religious community, we just talked about Paul, or the scientific community, as with the neuroscientists, three communities who normally don't see eye to eye.
Yeah.
They're on the same page about this one thing, though, about adolescence. You know what I'm saying? And the difference of adolescence and the instability of that time of life, as you know, compared to adulthood. So if all of these communities are on the same page, where is the legal community getting its frame of reference from?
That's my question.
You're right.
How do we end up in this situation? We're condemning children to die for something
right.
That they did as a child.
Right. And so, but I think, listen, I think it goes back to the beginning of the industrial era, and probably before that. But I, you know, I don't know if you remember during, if you read about, especially the times of Charles Dickens. You know, these ain't just stories. You know what I mean? The absence of the American legal system's sensitivity to children, you know, and society's capacity to allow children to be treated this way by the legal system, you know, including condemning young people to die in prison. You know, that could find it could you, it could very well have found its normalization in the industrialization of Great Britain.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Yeah, you know what the industrial economy became.
As adult
Huh?
labels. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, and that was brutal.
Yeah.
You know, that was brutal, you know, to satisfy the appetite of the industrialists, you know, lenient labor laws made children a prime source of workers. By 1830, children made up to 50% of the workforce. Children with parents who had parents were forced to work. You know, at nine, as young as 9 years old, and children who didn't have parents who were often were put to work at four. You know what I mean? And if you read about, study this time, you would see how brutal it was. You know, how brutal it was for children. You know what I mean? being maimed and even killed, working in these factories by the machines and so on and so forth, and developing respiratory issues from having to work around dust and fumes, and and all kinds of stuff like this. And then come to the US as far back as 1830. Matter of fact, no, you go back to the case of Godfrey versus State, or Aaron versus State, or State versus Guild. These were three different cases in the early 1800s that you can research, where children in each case, as two cases of 11-year-olds and one case of a 12-year-old in separate cases, were executed by, not by a lynch mob or anything, but by the courts. They were executed, like by hanging. I can't even imagine
Of course.
seeing something like that, a child, you know what I mean? Yeah, that was in the US.
Yeah, so
And
Gandhi, what I'm hearing you say basically is the legal system responding to the demands of capitalism. Capitalism
that's
is demanding labor from children's bodies, which defines them as somehow equivalent to adults in the labor industry, and then the law coming along and saying, okay, fine, we'll treat them as adults in other dimensions as well. Not every dimension, as we said before, but certainly in the interests of the state, which would include the ability of the state to kill them. So that's a remarkable, remarkable history. Thank you for walking
Yeah.
us through that.
Yeah, I mean, all and through the 20th century, George Stinney was the youngest person to be executed at 14 years old, 94 pounds, placed in an electric chair, seated on the Bible that he walked in the death chamber with.
Because he was too short.
Because he was too short, he was too small, you know what I mean?
That's just
And so
unthinkable.
Yeah, so it seems like, Nelson, when Nelson Mandela said there is no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way it treats its children, right? This question about how children are treated, how children are sentenced, is it's a question about the health of the soul of our society. It really is,
So we've got about 4 minutes before we have to wrap up, and I'm interested in bringing our listeners into back into your own biography. And so we had Roper v. Simmons in 2005, made it unconstitutional to sentence children to death, followed with other court cases culminating in Miller v. Alabama 2012.
Right, and don't forget, Catherine, in 2010, Graham versus Florida came down, and that case was about building off of Roper and referencing Roper heavily, and the science in Roper was about the court ruled in Graham versus Florida that it was unconstitutional to sentence children to life without parole sentences or to die in prison for cases that didn't involve a homicide. And yes, it had children in this country condemned to die in prison who didn't kill anybody. You know what I mean? And then 2 years later, in 2012, Miller finally came down. And then it still took, look, it still took, it's, it wasn't, well, the ship hadn't sailed. It's because different states were ruling different ways on it, Catherine. Some states were saying that Miller was a retroactive ruling. Some states were saying that it wasn't. And so it had to go back up to the US Supreme Court again. And another case was ruled on January 25th, 2016, called Montgomery. It was the Montgomery versus Louisiana, about the case of Henry Montgomery. And this was the case where the US Supreme Court said explicitly and unequivocally that, yes, Miller versus Alabama was retroactive, right? And that the burden of proving the permanent incorrigibility of a child, the irretrievable depravity or the irreparable corruption of a child, that burden is on the state, the Commonwealth, to prove that through a process, through a hearing where there's a consideration for, as I said before, a consideration for a wider latitude of mitigating factors. That's the language, right? And it said that if the Commonwealth fails, if the state fails to prove that a child is irredeemable, that is, that if they fail to prove that the child is permanently incorrigible, then the remainder of that child's days or the remainder of that person's days outside of prison must be restored. That was the language and that was the ruling, right? Now, flash forward. So you see how many times this case has been of children being condemned has been going back up to the U.S. Supreme Court, from Roper with death penalty to Graham with the children who didn't kill anyone to Miller, and then it was fought against, and then it had to go back up again
Jeez.
with Montgomery versus Louisiana, and then not less than 10 years later, after less than 10 years after Miller, another case went back up, Jones versus Mississippi. And this case, this ruling began rolling back Miller. You know what I'm saying? Basically saying that no, the courts do not have to, there does not have to be a process for proving the permanent incorrigibility of a child. That burden is not on the state. If a judge wants to resentence a child to life without parole at their resentencing, they could at their resentencing, they can do that without proving anything. And so basically, the point is this, that this issue is not, it's not a foregone conclusion. The ship has not sailed. It's still going back up to the US Supreme Court. And so this society still has failed to get it right as it relates to how a child, even a child who causes an irreparable or irreversible harm, should be treated.
Thank you for taking us through this history. It's really, really important to understand the basis of the ongoing fighting about whether or not the state should put itself in a position of condemning children to die in prison. And it's really interesting to see and hear the sort of sequence of arguments that have made their way up to the Supreme Court and how forcefully people are fighting in favor of condemning children to die in prison. And so we have to come to an end to the show today, but we will pick up this theme in our next episode where we'll talk about the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, the work that you're doing, how it relates to your understanding of the critical, fundamental importance of the right to redemption, which is also balanced with the right to accountability. And how the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth holds both simultaneously. So, Ghani, thank you so much for making time to talk with me again. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, to Aaron Pyle, our sound engineer, and to Daria Cullen, our executive producer, we are Justice Radio.